From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a special live broadcast from WBUR City Space on the future of dining in Boston. We'll hear from James Beard Award winner Tony Messina and culinary Oprah L. Simone Scott.
Coming into the industry and just not seeing a lot of women and not seeing a lot of women of color, it makes you question not only your belongingness, but like your ability, you know, like, do I belong?
And Ron Shake, the force behind Panera Bread, Tatte, and Life Alive on fast casual dining and paying workers well.
I very much want to have people that can speak to the food. And so to me, being able to pay our people more money to give them a quality of life is a gift to our business. It's a gift to our customers.
Plus, the Instagram effect on food culture.
Instagram is essentially the modern day billboard.
It's next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This show originally aired earlier today.
This is a special edition of Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We're talking about the future of dining in Boston as part of WBUR's week-long food series. And we're broadcasting live today from City Space, WBUR's new home for public conversation in Boston. Welcome to our in-studio audience. Our conversation today is airing live on 90.9 FM, and you can also listen at radioboston.org, and we're streaming on WBUR's YouTube channel. We'll be taking questions from our audience here throughout the hour at WBUR City Space, and also from you folks listening out there wherever you are in the world. We want to know what you think about the future of food and dining here in Boston. How has it changed? Where do you think the food scene in Boston maybe falls short? And where would you like to see it go? You can tweet us a question, at Radio Boston is our handle, or here in studio, our producers with microphones will be milling around the room, ready to take questions from our studio audience. Regardless of whichever format you use, send them in and we'll try to get to as many questions as possible during the broadcast. Let me turn to our first guests. Joining me on stage is the culinary Oprah, L. Simone Scott. She is the first African-American woman to be featured on PBS America's Test Kitchen, and she's also the founder of She Chef, a networking group for women of color in the food industry. L. Simone Scott, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Tony Messina. He's executive chef and partner at Uni and just won a little thing called the James Beard Award for Best Chef in the Northeast. Tony Messina, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Tony, let's start there. First of all, congratulations on the win.
Thank you.
What does it mean to you and, frankly, to Boston, which sometimes gets knocked for its food scene?
Yeah, I mean, it's for me, it's kind of a personal achievement. It's been something I've worked towards for... God, almost over 20 years now. So it's been just kind of a nice congratulatory feel for the entire restaurant, for the entire team that's put in a whole lot of work over the years. For me, it's about thanking the team and kind of showing them that they can work hard and actually work towards something and achieve a goal if they just put their head down and work. As far as the city goes, I think that over the last year or 2 years or so, we've had some pretty disparaging reports written about the food scene here. And for me, I'd like to try to turn that on its head and kind of twist things to skew things back to where it should be, which is, you know, it is a fun destination city. There's a ton of tourists that come here every year. And I think we can kind of put ourselves back on the map where we were supposed to be.
But now you told me that when you were at this awards ceremony, not everybody else was happy to see Boston win something else. Okay, people are sick of all the winning from Boston, Tony.
So I think what I said is there's a guttural hatred for Boston because of the amount of, you know, sports things that we win over the years. So I think, you know, thanks Red Sox and Bruins and Celtics and everybody.
Yeah, if we start winning food awards, then there's just no stopping us. And Elle, when we had you on Radio Boston earlier this year, you told us about your journey into the culinary world, which was a bit roundabout. You started for a while as a social worker, right?
Yes.
In Detroit. So this was a career change for you at age 28. How difficult was that? What did you run into?
It was difficult, you know, as any change would possibly be. But, you know, when you're faced with a moment where you have to make a very important decision, you start to think about the things that you really love, you know, what you want to be doing with your time and how long you want to do it. You know, these days your career has to go until you're like 75, you know. You have to think about what you're going to do for all those years. And for me, cooking was a no-brainer. It was like, it's just, that's the thing that I love doing. So I'm going to do that.
And so now you have this networking group, She Chef, for women of color in the industry, which I understand is partly because when you arrived, you didn't see a lot of people who looked like you in the culinary world.
That is correct. I saw a few women. I was usually the only Black woman in the kitchen, and I went to school with lots of women of color, all types, and I just didn't see that represented in the food industry, and so, I decided that that needed to change.
So where's the breakdown there? That's interesting then. So you had a lot of classmates
yes.
who were women of color,
yes.
but then when you get into the real working world,
mm-hmm.
there's a gap there. What's going on?
There are lots of different dynamics that play a part in that. One is certainly that, you know, culturally, domestic priorities vary, you know. There are a lot of people who are supporting their entire family. And for one, the rate of pay in the culinary industry is honestly not that sustainable. You know, you can't sustain a whole entire family off of that. And the hours can be a little non-traditional. And, you know, so these are challenges that most people encounter, but especially those who have, you know, varying family dynamics.
Tony, you started a little bit earlier in the food industry. I understand even at 14 you were working as a line cook, right? But I've also read that you thought about maybe a different career path. So how did you end up in food after all?
I started off very young. I mean, my family had me cooking when I was before I could walk when I was a child. So my first job when I was 14 was obviously going to be cooking. So I kind of took it and ran with it. And then, as Elle said, it's the pay rate is not sustainable. You know, there's many hours. It's very non-traditional hours. But I missed it. So when I tried to make a couple career changes and then realized...
You were going to be a cop, right? I mean, that was one of your...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was in the military for a while. And then after that, I became a Boston police officer. I was in the academy. And I realized that I just missed cooking and I missed being back in that type of environment. And eventually, I just pulled the trigger and moved back into the culinary world in my early 20s and, you know, just started going from there. But... Yeah, I mean, for me, it was forever I should have done that. You don't really recognize it. And we were talking backstage about how it's kind of like the mafia. It just keeps sucking you back in, even when you don't want it to. And that's kind of how I ended up. It's just it grabs a hold of you and doesn't let go.
So what changes, hopefully positive, are you observing within the food industry? Because in the last couple of years of a nationwide Me Too movement, culinary world in particular has had a reckoning of its own, and we've had a piece of that in Boston. Mario Batali has a presence here, and he's been one of the most prominent figures who has been sort of disgraced in that movement, but we've also seen folks like John Besh and others. I mean, what are you seeing right now, Tony?
Yeah, I mean, that very much was, I think, a striking moment for the entire industry as a whole, and I think that it's coming correct now to a point where people are starting to do the right thing for the sake of doing the right thing, not just because it's the cool thing to do nowadays. I think that people are now hiring based off of what they should have done in the first place. And I think it struck the fear of God into some people to say that what the difference between right and wrong is. And the people who were on the fence about what right is, right and wrong, is now they're now aware, hopefully. And I'm hopefully that corrects itself over the next year or so, because it's just kind of, I think people have had enough of putting up with things like, you know, the John Besh and Mario Batali type things.
Elle, what do you see going on? I mean, there's sort of Me Too. It sort of, I think, aligns with what you're trying to do at She Chef anyway. And it also is a reminder, as I introduce you as the first African-American woman on America's Test Kitchen. I mean, that alone is striking, that sort of venerable program went so long without one. I mean... Do you see a real change here, or is it sort of a form of tokenism, do you fear?
Well, I think that certainly women are feeling more courageous in expressing our disdain for, you know, the atmosphere and the work culture, and also being active participants in changing it. You know, we have a lot more, I mean, statistically, women and women of color are graduating. They're about 50% of culinary graduates as of 2016. So the culture and the dynamic is actually changing instinctively. You know, the more you have women in leadership, the more you have people empowered to make, you know, better decisions as it relates to their team. And also, I think when people see, you know, disparaging things happening in the community, sometimes they don't have the courage to speak up about it or make the change until, you know, something happens. I mean, it's unfortunate. You know, most of us, even as children, we don't not want to stick our finger in the socket unless we get shocked, you know, and it's like, yeah, okay, we need not continue with that, you know.
We're talking about food and culture with America's Test Kitchen's L. Simone Scott and James Beard Award-winning chef Tony Messina. And you, a reminder that you can join our conversation by tweeting us at Radio Boston, or if you're in the room, by flagging down one of our producers who is on the sides, microphone in hand. Chris, let me ask you about the food scene in Boston. You talked about this a little bit in your commentary on the awards, but what would sort of be your ideal version of a Boston food scene that is sort of unique from other cities, but also right up on par with the New Yorks and LAs and other cities that get higher acclaim?
Yeah, I think that the short answer would be that we need to band together more as a community first. I think that there are a lot of cities. We just traveled to New Orleans, and New Orleans has this amazing food culture that they're essentially one and the same. And the communities rally around the food, and the food rallies around the communities, and people stick up for each other because of that. And I think that we don't have that in Boston. What we have in Boston is kind of like these segregated areas where they have their own food and there's no melting pot. And I think that if we can somehow merge that back to where it was, we would probably have a more nationally recognized community of restaurateurs and operators. But at this moment, what we have is kind of a, I hate to say, a meat and potatoes type of city, but that's how people look at it from the outside in. And if we stay on that path, what we're going to be left with is just a ton of national chain operators that won't allow small operators like myself or Chris, who's going to be following me, to kind of thrive. And I think that's what place like New Orleans or Los Angeles or Chicago really allows their operators to do, is to kind of to thrive in their neighborhood and their communities. And we're kind of forced to kneel and bow to these people with greater dollar signs behind them than we have. So,
and Tony, my apologies. I was looking past you at Chris behind you and said Chris, but you're Tony. But I'm curious too. I mean, so you have a longstanding view of Boston growing up in East Boston. Right. And Elle, I'm curious what your take is, because you're a relatively recent arrival to Boston to join America's Test Kitchen. So what do you see as an ideal future for Boston as a cuisine capital of sorts?
Well, I think coming from New York, which is where I was for 10 years, I think that Boston has something extremely unique. It's that because it's not a town of a bunch of big names, it really is a town of people, who are like bootstrappers who decided that they want to start these food businesses and restaurants. You know, in New York, there's a method. Like, you have to first become a name, and then you can open up a restaurant. Here, you can have an idea, you can be a great cook, you can open up a restaurant, and then you can become a name. And that really levels the playing field. So while it does have a tendency to feel very, like that meat and potatoes feel, it actually kind of makes it fair for everyone. And I think that is going to be the most attractive thing about Boston in the food future. People are going to know that they can come here and legitimately bring their food culture, their experience on a plate, and people will be open to it. And potentially, they could be the next James Beard Award winner in 5 years.
How do chefs, though, and restaurateurs do that without sort of veering into cultural appropriation, right? I mean, this is something I know that chefs are thinking about a lot right now. And Boston is a city full of immigrants, and we do have a lot of different types of cuisine. I know, Tony, you serve a lot of different types of cuisine in your restaurants. So when you're forming your menus, how do you think about that? Doing it in a way that sort of honors the cultures that you're representing without just, appropriating and stealing from them?
What I do is I usually take a classical idea, meaning classical in the sense of it's true to the origin of the food. So whether that's Indian or South American in some regard, or if it's a national Canadian dish, we'll take it and we'll put the classic point of it as the focus, and then we'll just kind of build off of it. So whether that be a poutine dish, we'll take poutine and we're not going to bastardize it in any way. We're going to take it for what it's worth and then kind of put our spin on things so that we're still appreciating the culture and the cuisine for what it is, and then just putting our riff on it.
And Elle, as you think about that question as well, how do you see it playing out too on television? You're on America's Test Kitchen, and then also in some of these, I think people are learning more and more how to cook on TV, but also perhaps just sort of assembling food, right? We have like these, Blue Apron like food assembly kits. I'm curious, like, what your take is on that. I mean, you can sort of whip up a Japanese dish or a dish from another culture, in an instant, either something you learned off of TV or in one of these sort of ready-made kits, perhaps without appreciating where it comes from.
Well, I think that the beginning stages of creating, cultural appreciation is making sure that people have full exposure to different types of food, right? When you get these Blue Apron boxes or these different subscription types of things, usually enclosed, there's a lot of information about the food, the region, the ingredients, and where they come from, you know, and everyone cannot afford to dine out to get that experience. And I think that when you can receive it at your doorstep or, you know, in some other more practical home cook, you know, accessible way, I think it's great, you know. As long as you're open to getting the education and, you know, no one's trying to, you know, change the, make it the Yankee Doodle, you know, uni, you know, it's, you're good, you know. It's, you can appreciate it without appropriating it and just, you know, be mindful of expressing the origin of your dish.
So you mentioned not everybody can go out, afford to go out and eat all the time. And that is certainly true. And I wonder, Tony, particularly you as a chef right now, how you're thinking about that balance. I mean, at Uni, it's, I think it's fair to say it's pretty high-end stuff. But some of that is also perhaps a function of trying to pay a fair wage, right, to people who work there. I mean, Adam Chandler, who's writing a forthcoming book about the fast food industry, so not the Unis of the world, but he writes in the Washington Post this week that, citing the Labor Department, that 9 of the 12 lowest-paying jobs in America cluster largely around the food industry, right? I mean, so we're talking about the servers, the barbacks, the wait staff. I mean, this is a chronic problem in your industry. So maybe is one of the solutions that even though, you know, dining out can be so expensive, perhaps it should be expensive in some way so that those people are making a fair wage. How do you see that issue?
Yeah, I think there's a twofold answer there. I mean, there's Uni as a whole. We try to do our best to accommodate everybody, people who have large bank accounts and small bank accounts in the same breath. So we put things on the menu that are accessible to everybody. So that's one way to get around, just to have people attracted to the restaurant. But I think that as far as raising price points just to pay a wage, I think that is part of the answer. But I also think that not only is it just the pay, but it's also the benefits too. Not everybody's getting a fair shake at having sustainable health insurance nowadays. And I think that is equally or even more important than getting paid. So we at Uni, we do charge a premium for some of the things because we offer really great health insurance and paid vacation and sick time and 401k and retirement benefits. And I think that's really what we try to achieve, is that people can have a sustainable career, not just a quick job for a year.
Do customers get that though? I mean, do your diners know that that's part of what they're paying for when they come in?
We don't try to push that on anybody, but like that people who are in the restaurant and that work there know that why we do it. Our mission isn't to interrupt the diner's experience by telling why, you know, an Uni cost what it costs. What we tell them is that, you know, this is for a career and for the goal is to make people healthy and have, you know, a sustainable job so that they can go home to their families and be proud of themselves.
What do you think about that, Al? I mean, should we be having a different conversation in food about, you know, this is why it costs what it costs.
Right.
And perhaps if you're getting something that seems dirt cheap at a restaurant, it may be because people who work there aren't being paid a fair wage. I mean, should we have this conversation more in the food industry?
Absolutely. I think wage across the board in this country is a conversation that we should be having. I think the moment we start being more transparent about wages, we'll start having more equity and pay for men and women. That's a priority in my opinion. I do appreciate a restaurant that is transparent about percentages of, you know, their prices going for better wages. I'm okay with knowing that. I'm also okay with not knowing it. But I think that we're also talking about things that need to be dealt with on a legislative level, you know, in terms of like wages as it relates to careers. And, you know, I don't think that we shouldn't be having conversation about that. Wages should just be fair across the board. But little things like food waste. James Beard Foundation is doing a huge movement on how to eliminate food waste. That moves into your restaurant costs, you know, food costs. And when you can, you know, cut down on food costs, you can give your staff more money.
And sort of a related issue is food insecurity. And I mentioned that, too, because we had a conversation about this on yesterday's program. We had a woman named Shannon Uramchak on our show. She's on the board of directors at the Food Bank of Western Massachusetts. But until recently, she and her own family, four children, struggled with food insecurity. So this is a little bit of what she told us yesterday.
with four children, it had always been my habit to, you know, shop, do a big shopping trip at the beginning of the month and, you know, put lots of things in the freezer and lots of things that wouldn't go bad. Well, living in a small hotel room, that was not feasible. There was no way to keep things fresh. There was no way to really keep things frozen. And then there was the, just the issue of what healthy things can you really cook in a microwave?
So, Al, I know this is an issue that you're working on right now. What else can we do about food insecurity? Because I think in Shannon's case, as she was just describing, being in a motel shelter, mm-hmm. she had food stamps. She could buy some food at the corner store, but it was the microwave stuff. It wasn't the healthy, fresh stuff.
Well, you know, we have a lot of programs in this country that are not, I don't think they're advertised to citizens as they should. Like, you know, we have the SNAP program. People can use their SNAP benefits at farmers markets. You know, it's not limited to your grocery store, but in order to know that you can do that, you probably have to live somewhere where there is a pretty prominent or at least consistent farmers market. You know, food insecurity really starts with communities being educated about their food, their resources in their neighborhood. Lots of neighborhoods have kind of nailed that. Like, you know, Brooklyn, New York has a plethora of community gardens. Boston also has that. Detroit, over the past 3 years, has really grasped a hold of having more smaller urban markets. In Detroit, they also have Eastern Market, which has been the farmers market since my parents were children. So, you know, educating community members about the access in their community, and then not only that, how to utilize, you know, these things when they've gotten them, how to cook these things with their family.
El Simone Scott is on America's Test Kitchen and is also the founder of She Chef, a networking group for women of color in the food industry. El, thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thank you, Colin.
And Tony Messina, executive chef and partner at Uni and the 2019 James Beard Award winner for Best Chef Northeast. Tony, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Coming up, we'll talk with Ron Shake, the force behind Aubon Pan, Panera Bread, and more. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston, live at WBUR City Space.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers, and you are listening to a live special edition of Radio Boston, broadcasting before a studio audience at WBUR City Space, Boston's new home for public conversation. You can also listen at radioboston.org, and we're streaming on WBUR's YouTube channel. We've been talking about the future of food and dining in Greater Boston, and it sure looks like that future includes more fast casual dining. And my next guest oversees what could, I think, reliably be called a fast casual empire in Boston. Ron Shake has led Aubon Pan, Panera Bread, which he sold to JAB Holdings, I should say, in 2017 for $7.5 billion. You can buy a lot of broccoli cheddar bread bowls with $7.5 billion.
You certainly are selling a lot of broccoli cheddar bread
right,
bowls
to get to that
for
point.
$7.5 billion.
And since then, Ron has turned his focus to investment. He's launched Act 3 Holdings, which owns stakes in Life Alive Organic Cafe, right down the right next door to where we are right now, Kava, Tate Bakery and Cafe, and he's taking them all national. Ron, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to speak to you, Colin.
And we are also taking questions from our audience here on the floor at WBUR City Space and to all of you listening out there. We want to know what you think about the future of food and dining here in Boston. How has it changed? Where do you think it falls short? And where would you like to see it go? If you're in the room, flag down one of our producers on the sides. They've got microphones ready to field your questions. And if you're listening over the air somewhere, you can tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, Ron, I understand you just came to us here from your fifth Life Alive location, which is going to be opening next week in Back Bay. As I said, there's one right next door to our station. Fast casual.
Well, actually, interesting.
Go ahead.
It's opening at 420 Boylston Street next to Restoration Hardware. But that was an Aubon Pan that we opened 20 years ago.
Is that right?
So it's the full circle of my life.
There's a nice symmetry there.
Absolutely.
Did you be able to get a discount out of that history or no? Sorry, tough
Absolutely.
Luck.
This, okay, was, this right. was a location that when Aubon Pan was purchased by Panera, which I did 3 days before I stepped down as CEO, we were able to arrange with Panera the opportunity to take that lease over.
So I'm glad you brought up that history, because Au Bon Pan was really sort of, I think, at the vanguard of this fast casual dining phenomenon, which has only grown. So I wonder, what do you attribute that to, and what did you see before most?
Well, I've been doing this for 36 years. I opened my first restaurant right next to Park Street Station in a 400-square-foot space. It was a cookie store that ultimately grew into Au Bon Pan. But the reality is, for 36 years, my life has been about discovering today what's going to matter tomorrow, and really figuring out where is the consumer going and how do we make a difference in their lives. The truth of the matter is, the restaurant business is dirt farming. The world doesn't need another restaurant. Unless you can create an experience that gets people to walk across the street, to walk past other alternatives, and choose you because it's so particularly special, you might as well not even open because you're going out of business. And we've had success over a long period of time of determining what is really going to matter and then ultimately delivering it.
So let's talk about this third act of yours, right? So you've got the aptly named Act 3 Holdings, right? So Act 1, I assume, would be sort of the Au Bon Pan phase and then the Panera phase. And
very good in figuring that
okay,
out.
Okay, right. I can do my math. I can
absolutely
count to three. And so, you know, in both cases, though, you sort of bought up a smaller company and made it much larger, right? So there was an existing bakery and you kind of combined it with your cookie company to form Au Bon Pan. You had the St. Louis Bread Company, which you acquired and then sort of nationalized it as Panera. And you're doing something different, though, right? You're buying stakes in these other companies like Life Alive and Tate, but there are still founders in place there and you're they're Sherpa, I guess you could say. So how is this different?
Let's separate it. First, I'll just speak to Act 3. We're generally the majority shareholder.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what's material because we're really backing a founder, but we're the majority shareholder. The story of my life is really rooted in four transformations. And it's not in that first transformation was back in Au Bon Pan when we ultimately realized that consumers didn't want just the bread and croissant. They wanted to use the bread and croissant to make a sandwich. And that led to, ultimately, the first bakery cafe, which we opened as Au Bon Pan in Harvard Square and in Copley Place. That became a very powerful niche within the food industry. Many, many malls, developments wanted one. And that led Au Bon Pan, gave it the ability to go public in 91. In 93, we bought a little chain in St. Louis called St. Louis Bread Company. Thought that could be a gateway to the suburban marketplace. That led to the second major transformation. In 94 and 95, I would wander around the country, and I'd try to listen to consumers. And what I continually saw was one out of four fast food customers were rejecting fast food. Fast food was a mass-produced commodity product, and that consumers began to say, I wanted something better. I wanted real food. I wanted environments that engaged them. I wanted people that cared. I actually wanted some self-respect.
But they don't always have the time, right, to sit down for plated meals.
Exactly.
So how do you find that?
Well, speed
that
is part of that. But they really wanted food that was quick, and they wanted food that respected them, an experience that respected them. That led us in 1994 and 5 to conceptualize something called fast casual. And that fast casual paradigm, which we ultimately built Panera around, became today a $50 billion industry. And that's ultimately an understanding that there was a different consumer niche, this niche that wanted something better than fast food. That led to the third transformation, which essentially occurred in 1999, when I saw that this thing, Panera, which was one of four divisions in a big public company, we had Au Bon Pan, Au Bon Pan International, Au Bon Pan Manufacturing, we also had Panera, it had the potential to be nationally dominant. And again, I can remember saying to myself, we've got this powerful thing, but we're going to screw it up. And a friend looked at me and said, Ron, what would you do if Panera owned Au Bon Pan, not the other way around? And I said, if I had any strength, I would monetize every asset we had. I'd go down there myself and make it grow. And I'm the kind of guy that if I say I'm going to do it, I want to go do it. I came back, and I actually went and did it. And
it was
sold.
A big gamble, though, right? I mean, because you had three successful brands at that point.
I had a public company, yes. Yeah. But here's the fascinating thing about transformation and change and betting on the future. You could have bought our stock at that time for a penny on the dollar that it actually sold for. One penny. And people say to me all the time, Ron, why didn't you tell me? And I want to look at them and go, Don't you get it? Right? Don't you understand? I was telling you, nobody wanted to listen. And when you're going through change, when you're betting on the future, nobody wants to hear it.
Well, you also didn't want to go to jail for insider trading too, though, right? I mean, that was
no.
Also,
we were a public
company. I'm teasing you.
No, Colin, we were telling people.
Yeah.
The truth is, in the food industry and everywhere, nothing's proven till it's done.
Sure.
And the reality of what we do as entrepreneurs, as creative people, is actually figure out where the future is going and make those bets. And that's been the key. And the last one, the fourth transformation, I stepped down in 2009 to do political work. I came back. I was still the executive chairman of Panera. And by that time, it had become a hugely successful company. It had the best performance of any restaurant company over the last 20 years, 25% annual appreciation. And I'd stepped down, and I was still doing the acquisition work and as executive chairman. And one weekend, I wrote a memo how I would compete with Panera if I weren't part of Panera. And the guy who took over from me asked me if I would go to work on it. And I spent a year working. I loved it. I was back in the doing of the doing, and I loved it. And at that time, he had a personal issue. He couldn't travel. I came back as CEO, and I put in place that vision. That vision was digital. That vision was loyalty. It was clean food. It was omnichannel. And those themes that we played out over the next 6 or 7 years became the themes of the restaurant industry. And again, Panera, which had already had become a mature company, took off. And it left me in a place where by 2017, I was running the 10th largest restaurant company in America, one of the most successful, the most successful of the prior 20 years. And I really worried, how do we make these long-term transformations? And I understood, I voted 17% of the stock. I understood I had this credibility. But if I didn't keep doing that, how would that happen? And it was in that decision I made, it was in that perspective I made the decision to sell the company to protect it. To protect its ability to make long-term decisions, because in a public marketplace, it's really difficult to do that. Once I'd done that, I realized it wasn't the place for me to stay. I knew how to run it as an independent entrepreneur. And I really wanted to help grow. I wanted to help future entrepreneurs grow. People like Zarit Orr, who's the founder of Tate, who we had bought the company, we'd bought an interest in the company, the majority stake in it as Panera. I then bought that stake from Panera, and we have no relationship with Panera anymore, and Zarit and I are now partners in Act 3. We did the same thing with Life Alive, which we bought from its founder. I had a vegan chef friend, Leah Dubois, who I loved. I thought she deserved to bring her food to the world. We made her the culinary director, and we took off with Life Alive.
But the common denominator here is that you're in more of an advisory role here, right? I've heard you describe it as Sherpa management, right? You're not the CEO in there hands-on every day. So
no,
is that hard? I mean, is it hard to kind of give up that control, or are you relishing this new role?
You ask any of our chef friends that are here, it's wonderful to not have that responsibility. but the truth of the matter is, it's not different. We have three principles in Act 3. The key to the restaurant industry is about having a better competitive alternative, having something better for the guest, a better mousetrap. And the reality is that's what we focus our teams on. We do that with something called founder-friendly money. We've taken $300 million, put it into a fund. We have no pressure, no need to meet any investor needs. We're willing to give our investments as much capital as they need. They don't have to take on preferred instruments that get hung around their neck. We have what we call consistent capital. That's piece one. Second, you refer to it as Sherpa management. What that basically means, it's tougher to build a nationally dominant concept in this country than it is to climb Mount Everest. We've done it. And I and all of my partners, Keith Pascal, Noah Eljabin, and Jim Rand, Brian Griffin, all of my partners have run and been part of running major companies. And our role in those boardrooms is not to worry about liquidity in the next financial event. Our role is to help them avoid mistakes.
Which has to be incredible peace of mind, because restaurateurs are always thinking about where is that next dollar going to be coming from. But I do want to ask you a question we got from Twitter here, Ron, before
sure.
we run out of time, because we've got a question from someone who says he or she is a current employee of Tate, so I think this is a good one for you. And he or she writes that I make $10 an hour. I'd like to see it return to predictable, livable wages that are not subsidized by the consumer in the form of gratuities. So how about that? We were talking about sort of a living wage in the restaurant industry in the last segment. How are you thinking about that?
Well, let's talk about it. So I'm fully in favor of a livable wage, have been on the record as that, you know, professionally and personally for a very long time. Having said that, we do live in a world today where tipping has become prevalent. I don't know what it is in Tate very specifically. I was just looking at, you know, this data on Life Alive, literally just a couple of hours ago. We're pushing with tips our non-service people in the kitchen making, you know, $20 an hour or more with $10 an hour or more in tipping. And so, I mean, we have really come far from a world where we were paying $5, $6, and $7 an hour to where we're pushing compensation to $20 an hour or more. And there is a question how much of this the consumer is willing to handle and where this all ends up. But we favor having sustainable businesses and paying above whatever is the competitive wage in total when you consider all the forces of compensation.
One other thing that I want to ask you about that was in the news recently, we mentioned at the top that you had sold Panera Bread to JAB Holding Company. People may also know that it owns Krispy Kreme, Insomnia Cookies, which we have one down the street, Dr. Pepper, Keurig. So there's a lot of familiar brands in there. And JAB recently acknowledged a German newspaper report that the company's controlling family was a staunch supporter of the Nazi regime and profited from forced labor in its factories and private villas during World War II. So long time ago, realize you sold before this news report, but the one of the companies or the brands I should say that they own is Intelligentsia Coffee, which you know is served at your Life Live Cafe. So I guess I'm wondering how you're thinking about this news. I mean, what was your reaction, and does it change your business calculus at all?
I think it took the air out of us. I mean, it's you know it's really concerning. You know what does it mean? Who are they? This isn't any of the people presently involved. The people I've dealt with are French and American. They're, you know, and this is not the family. It's the father of the family, you know. And frankly, the truth of the matter is I don't have a role in JAB, and I don't have a role in Panera today. So there's not much I can do.
But do you do business with them, I guess? Or, I mean, or once we start reckoning with that history, is it just a rabbit hole that you would never find an end to, you know?
Well, I think that all of us as consumers need to vote our wallets. I think that's totally appropriate. I think we should do business with people we respect and we honor. I can only tell you that the nature of what JAB is, which is frankly backed by some of the largest institutions in the United States and in Europe and around the world, these are credible and serious people. Who, when I went through this transaction, I respected. And I will tell you that at a very personal level, I still love Panera. I love the people that are there. I profoundly am, you know, committed.
I've heard you say you still eat there like four times a week.
I still do.
That's loyalty.
I mean, you know, I care deeply about it. So, I you balance all this out, and I basically support the people of Panera doing their work, and I support them doing a great job for our listeners as guests and customers.
That's Ron Shaikh. He's the force behind Panera Bread, Life Alive, and more. Ron, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston, live at WBUR CitySpace.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. The social media platform Instagram says more than 500 million accounts are active every day. And within that figure, every week, there are regularly a million posts under the hashtag food. Instagram and Instagram influencers are making their mark on the Boston food scene. And restaurants are taking notice. Some host events and promotions with and for influencers. Others have made it a point to make their restaurants more photogenic. So what is that hashtag Boston food scene all about? And just how big of of an impact is it having on how people find and eat their food? Well, joining me now is Brenda Nguyen. She runs the Instagram account Wandering Boston Eater. Hey there, Brenda.
Hey, how's it going?
And Chris Coombs is with us. He is a co-owner at Boston Urban Hospitality, which owns D-Bar and Boston Chops, among others. And I just want to point out they both have more than 26,000 followers on Instagram. Listeners, if you have a question, you can tweet us at Radio Boston, or if you're in the room, flag down one of our producers on the side. Brenda, I want to begin with you because this sounds like a very busy side hustle. You have a full-time job, as I understand it, in the pharmaceutical industry, and you still find time to visit all these restaurants and document your experiences. And you've described yourself as more of a visual storyteller than just a mere Instagram influencer. What do you mean by that, a visual storyteller?
Yeah, so I definitely like to utilize my platform to talk about my experiences. And I do that through both food and my captions that I write within the Instagram posts as well, and also pairing that with my blog posts that I write on my own personal page too. And it is all very anecdotal because at the end of the day, the restaurant and dining experience is incredibly subjective. And I really try to drive that because my experience that I have dining and even my tastes in terms of what I enjoy in food, dining, and just an atmosphere can vary from, you know, Chris or the person who's, you know, sitting in the audience and everything too. So it all varies from person to person. So I really try to drive that force that this is my experience. This is my story that I'm trying to drive and tell.
And I've noticed that as you do that, it's not all about the food. I mean, we're seeing some pictures for those who are in the room behind of these, you know, lovely looking plates that you're eating. But at the same time, you often include lengthy posts with your visual imagery, often with detailed observations about the wait staff or back of house. I imagine that's intentional. What are you trying to highlight there?
I'm trying to highlight that everybody should think more than just what is the plate of food that's being presented in front of me and really start to think about the operation that's, you know, driving that dish that's coming to be presented in front of you. So in the pharmaceutical industry, I work full-time in supply chain and I manage clinical supply chain. So that is an operation, and a restaurant is an operation in and of itself. So understanding that it isn't just, here's my plate in front of me, wow, I'm going to eat it, it's delicious. It's also, who is the person who's bringing this plate to me? Who is the team? Where is that crossover between the front of house and back of house, you know, at Expo? And then it goes back to, where is, you know, what's the operation in the back of house and how is that working with the chefs and everything and the line cooks and the dishwashers? And how is that even being connected with, you know, the back waiters and everything too? And also then ultimately, how is the food being sourced? So all of that is a play in the operation, and it's just thinking so much more than just, this is my dish, this is my meal, that's all that's in front of me, point blank.
I believe the lobster dish that we're seeing here in the room is from a recent trip to Portland, right? That you went up to a restaurant called Bluefin. You said that you were invited by the chef, Gil Plaster, to come and try the food. For people who aren't familiar with the business side of being an Instagram influencer, how does this work? So somebody extends an invitation like that, and then are you compensated in some way? Do you feel an obligation to say nice things because you got an invitation? How does it work?
So it does depend if I'm there for strictly the photographic purposes or if I'm utilizing my social media platform to talk about what exactly my experience is. And most of the time it is for trade purposes. So I am essentially comped a meal, and in compensation, I am utilizing my platform to describe my experience. This all ultimately started because I was dining out of my own pocket, and I still do oftentimes dine out of my own pocket more so than I actually go for comped experiences. And this is because ultimately I really do enjoy divulging into the food scene and learning about what is the operation behind the food and how is food being sourced, because food is a great part of my life.
So Chris Coombs, let me turn to you because you've really kind of gone all in as far as a restaurateur embracing the Instagram culture to the point that at Boston Chops downtown, you've actually installed what you call the first restaurant Instagram table in the United States. Forbes reports that you spent $10,000 on this baby. So this was an investment, right? So it's this beautiful booth, perfect lighting. And what's the idea here? If you want people to come in and Instagram, here we can see it if you're in the room behind us. You want the food to look terrific for marketing purposes? What's the
idea? Sure. Well, first off, I just want to commend Brenda because not everyone spends the time to really report on what we do as restaurateurs. And, you know, I'm always thankful for when she comes in, because that's not always what it's all about. And it's awesome that somebody's doing that as media evolves and things change. But, you know, one of the things that Ron was discussing earlier with you was just sort of anticipating what's going to happen next. And, you know, I saw, you know, it took about 2 years to build Boston Chops downtown. I saw this movement toward Instagram and food photography. And, you know, one of the things I ran into with Duave, which is my fine dining French restaurant right across the street from Tony's great restaurant, Uni, in the Back Bay, is, you know, the lighting isn't always the most appropriate for great food captures. And as a chef who really loves cooking and loves beautiful food, it's very important to me that the image of our cuisine is captured with integrity, and that it's a fair representation of our hard work and our team's hard work and the experience that we're providing for the guests. So with Boston Chops downtown, which was the former Mantra space, we inherited a space with tons of character, an old bank from the 1800s with no natural light and no windows. So my task for my design team and engineers was, how do we simulate daylight? Because I am a terrible photographer. I get lucky sometimes, but I am generally not a photographer. But the only way that I know how to make pictures look nice is with really beautiful natural light, taking a picture next to a window. And I actually first wanted to selfishly create the Instagram table for myself to have a nice place to capture the beautiful cuisine that we were serving. And then it sort of morphed and evolved into an idea to say, you know, this would be a really fun amenity. And the thing with the restaurant business in general is I really think that we're moving toward an experience-based economy. So the Instagram table at Boston Chops Downtown is really about providing an additional experience for our guests who sit at it to really enjoy and be social and take pictures. And, you know, I often say that right now my greatest competition in the restaurant business is not other restaurants. It's actually Netflix. It's really getting people to...
Just to get them out of the house.
Yeah, get them out of the house and get them eating. And I think that that's when we talk about where the restaurant business is going and where it's headed, I think that we're going to see this continued expansion to really feed the stay-at-home economy elegantly. But that's really... another story for another day.
Well, but do you worry at all, though, about, you know, so if you're making maybe a whole restaurant at some point more Instagram friendly, that you maybe diminish the ambiance for the in-person dining experience? I mean, as you say, you know, so how do you find that balance where you want people to be in the moment, right, and not just on their phones?
Sure. I mean, you know, Forbes was super nice to come out and say, you know, that the world's first Instagram table had opened at Boston Chops. But, you know, making restaurants more Instagram friendly, that's nothing new. I mean, every cafe and cookie shop and restaurant that's out there, they all have neon and things that photograph really well, kitschy things to sort of identify, you know, so people can really share where they are. And, you know, it is the new form of marketing. And I think that that's really a result of this generation's attention span being so short. So you sort of have to present yourself to this generation the way that it's digestible. You have to get them excited about what your experience is and why, you know, as a generation coming out of school with such a tremendous debt overhang, why they should budget those dollars to come and eat at your restaurant. So I think that we're all looking toward creative ways in this industry to attract people to our restaurants and to our establishments. And ultimately, it can be really challenging because there's always going to be somebody out there in the restaurant business who's willing to do it for less. And that really plays into the discussion from earlier about livable wage. The funny thing with food is most people understand what it costs, right? Like, we're generally all aware of what a chicken costs, right, when you go to the supermarket. So it's really hard for most people to understand why, when they go to a restaurant, that they have to pay $33 for a chicken breast. And I understand that fully, but I think as the consumer, we really need to come to terms with what it is that we're willing to pay for food, right? Because you can't say, hey, I want everyone in the restaurant to make $20 an hour, and then simultaneously I'm only willing to pay $17.95 for chicken.
Yeah, those things don't jive. Pay for it. Just, you know, in the moments we have left, I do want to squeeze in one audience question, at least from here. Melinda from Shrewsbury has a question. Our own Paris Alston is at the ready with the microphone. Go ahead, Melinda.
I'm wondering what you think about the ticketed restaurants. So there's some like Shore Leave in by the Ink Block. They have tickets. You buy a specific ticket. On Instagram, they'll tell me how many tickets are left for that night. What do you think about that idea?
Conceptually, I love the idea personally. I think that sort of retraining people to change their habits is the more challenging part. One of the things that I struggle with as a restaurateur, we're a small size company, but still larger than an independent freestanding restaurant, is the amount of money that I send annually to OpenTable is about $350,000 a year right now, just to get reservations, to get people in the building. And the constant fear is that if I were to get rid of OpenTable, that perhaps I wouldn't have as many guests. So the ticketing system's really nice, because another thing that we deal with as restaurateurs are people who either make reservations and then cancel last minute or no show, or my favorite, the humans who make reservations at multiple restaurants and then just go to whichever one they're around at that time that evening. It's super inconsiderate behavior. It makes our food purchasing more challenging. It makes our planning more difficult. But the ticketed system is really a wonderful one.
That's Chris Coombs. He's a co-owner at Boston Urban Hospitality, which owns D-Bar, Duav, and Boston Shops. Chris, thanks a lot for your time today.
Thank you kindly.
Also with us, Brenda Wynn. She runs the Instagram account Wandering Boston Eater with more than 26,000 followers. Brenda, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
And thanks to our live audience and those of you who are listening on 90.9 WBUR and watching on YouTube. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with City Space Engineering today by Matt Lissette. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.